What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Welcome to my neighborhood, the Avenue. I grew up here, and each week I'll be sharing the sounds and stories of the people that made the Avenue great. Welcome back to the Avenue. This is the first episode in our two-part series featuring Debbie Nelson, a legendary Naptown vocalist known for her work in blues and soul music. Debbie rose to prominence in the late 1960s, singing R&B music at local clubs like the Surfside 7. Over the years, Debbie has worked with some of Naptown's greatest musicians, including Jimmy Cole, Billy Wooten, and members of Funk Incorporated. Debbie continues to perform today as a member of the In Full Transition Blues Band. For the next 2 weeks, Debbie will join us to share her memories of growing up on the Avenue and her early years performing on the Naptown music scene. Let's start this week's show with a classic track from Debbie. Recorded live at the Slippery Noodle in 1994, this is Debbie Nelson and the Rebirth Blues Band with Wet Match.
Your love is like China, not a fire with a wet match. You won't even get a spark like that. Every time she mentions your name, say they call you good love. Good love, daddy.
That was Debbie Nelson and the Rebirth Blues Band with Wet Match. WFYI's Kyle Long recently spoke with Debbie. They discussed her early years growing up on the Avenue. Debbie attended Crispus Attucks High School and lived in Lockville Gardens, a federal housing project built along Indiana Avenue in 1938. Let's join their conversation.
So, Debbie, last time we talked, you told me you grew up in Lockville, right?
Yes.
Were you born in that neighborhood?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about your life in Lockville.
Well,
when did your parents move into Lockville?
I remember seeing a picture when I was 3. So that would have been 1952. Hmm. And I remember sitting in a little wooden chair, and because you know that was the projects, and we only had heat, electric. So you didn't have any gas or anything. So, they kind of had you over a barrel, because if you couldn't pay your rent, they would turn your heat off. So then you were in the cold. And we didn't have much furniture. And I remember probably at the age of 7, I noticed how other families that I had visited would have furniture. And so one day I pulled, back then they had like these steel chairs, aluminum type, red at the front and white around them for your kitchen chairs. So I remember pulling 2 into the living room, and I took a green army blanket that my brother had bought home from the service, and I took 2 pillows, and I decided I was going to make a couch like everyone else had. And my mom came home from work, and she said, "What is that?" And I said, "It's a couch." And she said, "Oh, it's so pretty." I remember her saying that, because if she had said, "Get rid of that," that would have crushed me, you know. So she said it was very pretty and everything, and so I kind of felt like I belonged then with the rest of the people who at the time I didn't realize was just as poor as we were. But it was a village. I've always maintained that concept. Even in the neighborhood I'm in now, I act like it's a village. And I love in the spring or when the weather gets nice and everyone's sitting out, I love going out and saying, good morning, everybody, you know, and they're like, morning, Debbie. Has anybody had any coffee? I mean, just those regular things that I remember in Lockfield. And I love surprising my next door neighbors who are older than I am with dinner sometimes and just knocking on the door and say, hey, here you go. It gives me a good feeling to make them feel good. And they're at the age now where neither one of them can drive. So still pulling on those roots from Lockfield and the village. When I'm going to go to the store, I'll tell them, get your list ready. I'm going to the store. And it's just a good feeling. Somebody's child is in the street. It's like, get out of that street. And nobody's ready to beat you up or don't say that to my child. And they didn't do it back then. It was like, I had to tell so-and-so-and-so to get out of the street, you know. And then mom gets on you and gets in trouble. When you got in trouble at school, the teachers would pin a note on you for your parent. And when you got home, if you came through the yard where all the elders sat watching the grandchildren play, they saw that note, come here. And once you got over there, they were going to whop you. And once you got upstairs and your mom saw that note, she whopped you too. It wasn't anybody coming out saying, what you hit my child for? You don't put your... No, it was a village. And we all took care of one another. I didn't realize we were poor. It was rich to me because of the people I encountered. As I had said before earlier, my mom had diabetes and she was a functional alcoholic. But she took me to church every Sunday, morning service, BTU, Sunday school, came back home, had a nice little Sunday dinner, which I thought was nice. It was just the regular thing. And with her diabetes, sometimes conflicting with her alcohol, she would have what was called an insulin reaction, where she would go into seizures, usually late at night. Back then, only one person in the whole building at that time might have a phone, and it was always late. So I'd have to go knocking on doors to get to a phone. But before that, I'd have to go out of the apartment building and through the walkway, across the street, over to the variety store, which was called Mr. Tyler's Variety Store. He wore a white apron tied in the back, and he always had a big, fat, stinky cigar. And by the time I would get over there, he closed at 11. It would always be past that time, so I'm knocking on the window. Mr. Tyler, I need some Donald Duck orange juice and a pound of Domino sugar. My mama's having a seizure, and I don't have any money. Come on in here, Deborah J. And, you know, he would lock the door and everything. He would give it to me. He knows my mom would pay him the next week. And then I would come out, and there were pimps and prostitutes and drug addicts. There were many a nights when I was taking that lonely walk where they would say, hey, little girl, where are you going? I got to go over here to get some orange juice and sugar for my mama and Mr. Tyler. Come on here. They would walk me across that street. They would stand outside Mr. Tyler's until I came back out. And they would walk me back home to my apartment. Which floor are you on? Top floor, third floor. Get up there, open up that window, let us know you got inside, and lock that door. And I would do it. Nothing to worry about. It's so different from now. So much has changed. Even these people who were considered the low of the low still had enough caring in them and enough dignity in them to want to protect a girl child who was coming out at a dangerous time and only depending on their faith and their Lord to get them there, and he worked it out every time. My mother worked every day. She either worked at foundry or the laundry, or she worked cleaning hotel rooms. She worked every day, but on the weekends, she would go. And without my brother there, I was like an only child. But I can truly say I was never hungry. She knew what I liked. I liked Mr. Tyler's chocolate malts. And back then, they had the big Mr. Good bars for 25 cents. Now they're $2.95, the same size, okay? She would get me one of those. She would get me some rib tips from Barbecue Heaven. And she would get me a True Romance magazine and a detective magazine. She would set me up just fine. And then she would go with her friends. I would go to sleep. And then sometimes I would wake up and she wasn't there. And the loneliness from her not being there, I would eat to satisfy that loneliness. I didn't know then, but since I was happy, you know, have grown, I understand now how I had so much trouble with my weight, because that was the satisfaction I got. That fulfilled that loneliness that I was feeling from her not being there. So she never left me without food or anything. She would always come back and check on me and everything, but then she would leave again. And only through growth did I find out and realize, and only after having gone through the hurt and the pain and the heartache that she must have gone through, did I understand that where she was weak, I'm stronger. Where she turned to alcohol to ease her pain inside, I didn't. So it was only through growth that I began to understand how you get to that point. And I've asked the Lord to forgive me for the way I used to be so embarrassed and so mad when she would come home intoxicated. Because I had to look back and realize that she still took care of me. She still knew that I knew the Lord. She still made sure of that. She still made sure that I had somewhere to sleep and all those times. So she took care of me the best way she knew how. And so I always love her for that. But I had to go through it to understand what it will make you do when you're desperate like that. And it has made me a better person.
We've been listening to vocalist Debbie Nelson sharing her memories of growing up on Indiana Avenue. Let's pause and listen to music from Debbie Nelson and the In Full Transition Band. From the album, Mark My Words, we'll hear, Is That Asking Too Much?
If I could just be with you sometimes and just see you, oh baby, sometimes that's all I ask of you, ooh baby, that's all I want you to do. Now tell me, is that asking too much?
That was Debbie Nelson and the In Full Transition Band with Is That Asking Too Much? Debbie recently spoke with WFYI's Kyle Long. Let's return to their conversation as Debbie recalls her early years in music.
And Debbie, you talked about the community of Lockfield being rich. Yes. You also grew up in an area that was culturally rich.
Yes.
You know, just outside your neighborhood were theaters, nightclubs, where some of the best musicians in the world were playing.
Yes.
At what point did you become aware of that? Is that something you knew about as a young girl, or is that something that as a teenager or maybe growing up you kind of realized you were in the middle of something really different?
I remember seeing, We always walked downtown, my mom and I, and we would pass by all the clubs. We'd go downtown on one side of the street and come back on the other, and I remember seeing the Pink Poodle, and I would try to peep in, come away from that door, come away from that window, just the place to play, all of these places that I would, the Downbeat, the Sunset, I would see those places, but I was more interested then in the lighty old theater where you paid to go in to see the one-legged woman or the hairy man, or Walker Theater where you paid 5 cents to get in and 10 cents for a box of good buttered popcorn with the bag greasy and 2 cents for the red lollipops on the little white cloth stick. Oh, I loved it. I didn't start really getting into music until one of the friends, one of the ladies I became friends with, she was older than me, and she was into music. And sometimes when I would be outside on the bench waiting for my mommy to come, and all the other kids' parents had called them in, most of them were single women with children, and would call them in, and I'd just be still sitting out there, and she used to come to the window and say, "Deborah, come on up here. Miss Bertha, you come up here and stay till Miss Bertha gets home. I cook some pork chops and some corn, you know, and just come up here and we'll look out far out the window, and then I'll let her know you're here and I'll walk you downstairs." Well, after a while of being up there with her, she started playing music. Well, I would listen to music. We would go to Mr. Tyler's little place, and he had a jukebox where you put a nickel in and you could play three songs. So I was would it be into it, but I wasn't really interested in spending my money on music. I wanted to get candy, anything sweet. I didn't want, nope, I'm not doing that one. So after a while, I became aware of when I would go in there, I would hear the music. So one day she called me up there, Rose, and she said, "I'm thinking about putting a group together. Me and my sister, and how about you? We could do some songs." And I'm like, "I don't think I can sing." And she's like, "Yeah, you can sing. You can just pitch in where you can." I remember one of the first songs we learned was "Don't Mess With Bill." No, 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 no. The Marvelettes. And we practiced that song for months and months and months trying to get in tune. And we finally did. And then one day we appeared on a show. And we had our little group together for about 6 months. And then after that, my daughter's father was 6 years older than me. So I was like 17 when I met him. He was already 23. So he was going out to clubs. And a couple of times he would sneak me in. Not only that, he knew about the little group, so he would talk to the band and, you know, have them call me up and everything. And so that's really how it started. And when I saw the reaction from the audience, that gave me more courage to go on. So that's really where it started, down on the avenue in the little clubs. And then before we stop from there.
Yeah, before we get to your work in the nightclubs as a solo artist, this group, it was the Tonettes, is that right? And your neighbor was Rose Johnson, is that her name? And this was a trio, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And you were singing, like, at school events?
Yes.
You weren't going into clubs, were you?
No, Yeah. School events. And I think we might have even done the Walker one time.
Okay. The Christmas show, probably.
He knows so much. Man, the Tonettes. I couldn't even think of that name. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. And I wanted to ask you about your experience at Crispus Attucks, because from what I understand, you were also singing at the school, and you were in theater as well. Yeah. You did a Shakespeare play, right? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, The Merchant of Venus.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did two musicals, Bally High. Mm.
South Pacific?
Yeah, yeah, South Pacific. And then the other one was The Cowboy. God,
Oklahoma?
I had it in my mind. I can't think of the name of it now. But out of that, I was offered a scholarship for music. And when I graduated, they told me the scholarship, they didn't have the available. It was no longer available. So that was when I graduated at 17. So that went out the window. And then it was my daughter Dana's father who really threw me out there into different clubs and things like that, and after-hours clubs and that type of thing. I was trying to think the other day of what song was that I would sing, and he would throw the first dollar out there, and then they would just throw dollars up on that stage. It was a slow song. I can't remember it. But I did that, and I sang at regular clubs and then the after-hour clubs. He was the one that just got me in and took me around and kind of showcased me. So that
was how I first got started. This is when you were 17?
Mm-hmm. 18.
18? Okay. Mm-hmm. What were the after-hours clubs you were singing in? Do you remember the names?
The Apple. It was up the steps, catacorner across the street from the place to play.
So, yeah, you're 17 or 18 years old. Was it your boyfriend or your husband at the
My
time?
My boyfriend. Your boyfriend. With a three-month-old baby.
Yeah, yeah. And he's taking you into nightclubs to perform. What was that like for you? Was that intimidating? Was it exciting? How did you feel about it?
A little of both. That's where I met. Well, we all grew up together, the Four Sensations.
Mm. Kenny Dodson.
Yeah,
and
we
Joe
grew
Dodson.
Up together. Yeah. Their mama, her name was Kat. We called her Kat. She knew my mother, Bertha. So we all grew up in that same. We may have even been in the same building because in Lockville there's different buildings that you live in, and each building has four to five individual buildings with the apartments in each one. So.
So at this point, your primary musical experience had been singing in school, mm-hmm. in the plays and different things, and the Tonettes, right?
Yes.
And now all of a sudden you're in nightclubs.
Yeah.
How did you kind of figure out what to do in that situation? What was sort of your, you had to put on a show for people? Was mm-hmm. that did that come natural for
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I couldn't do any planning because I didn't know how. Mm. I just started listening to songs that I wanted to sing and then picked them and then... When I would go to a club and after I would sing, just as a guest and they would hire me, then it was getting with the band, going over the songs, tweaking them here and there, and it was doing it. And the one club that I sang the most at was Sunset 7, which was Sunset 7.
Surfside 7.
Surfside 7.
Yeah, it was over on 24th Street, right?
Uh-huh.
MLK now.
Yeah. 4 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how I was able to buy my first home. Mm. Because back then, as entertainers, you didn't get any credit to buy a home. Because we were not considered stable. Mm. Because you're in and out of town, you're on the road, and all of that. And I remember when I applied for it, it was a special program. And at that time, it was called the 231 plan, where you could apply for a home on low income. And if you qualified and had been on your job long enough, you could get it. So they really didn't think I'd be able to get it as an entertainer. But after talking to Sue Ann Holland, the owner, and she told them I had been there 4 years, they called me and told me, we're going to consider that as a regular job because she said, you have never missed a date and you're doing good. And so we're going to let you buy the home. So. That was how I got my first home, and I was 21 years old then. Yeah, and my little girl was almost 3.
In what year was it you started singing in clubs? You said you were 18.
Mm-hmm.
What year would that have been?
So that would have been 67. Well, not long after I graduated. Mm-hmm. I graduated in 67 at 17.
Wow, so by 68 you were in the clubs.
Yes.
And it seems like you were successful very early on because, like you said, you had this residency at mm-hmm. Surfside 7.
Mm-hmm.
You were playing with very prominent musicians
yes.
in the city. What was it about you that was... catching on so quickly with people? What can you look back on that and see what talent you had or what kind of charisma you had that was really getting people's attention?
I did a lot of Gladys Knight songs, Aretha Franklin songs, which were very popular then. I remember one particular night at Surfside, I did, and I still want to go back to doing that song, Gladys Knight's I Don't Want to Do Wrong. Oh, my goodness. And I sang that song. And I looked out there in the audience, because usually I'll sing with my eyes closed, and that's because I'm shy. And I looked out there in the audience, and there were men at the table with their women wiping their eyes, tears rolling down their face. And that just pushed me even more to just tear this song up, because then I'm feeling their hurt. And I had felt that hurt before, so I really got into it then. And I sang it through. I believe it was Bobby Watley and Jimmy Munsford that were playing it. And when I finished, I was so overcome with my own sadness that I had to go outside the club and stand and get some air. And I stood out there, I took my break out there, and then I remember Sue Ann Holland coming out, and she said, Debbie, you have to come back in. And I said, I am. I just need a break from this. I'm really trying to stop crying myself. And she said, no, you got to come back in now. I said, just give me about 5 more minutes. She said, no, you have to come now. They're going to tear my club down. And when she opened the door, you could hear them beating on the table with their glasses and, you know, whistling and all of this. And I was like, wow. And I had already, by the time I finished, I sang that song 4 times. I don't want to do wrong. It was amazing. That was truly amazing.
Don't want to do wrong. But you've been gone away so long, and I hope you'll understand that it's really.
Don't touch that dial. Echoes of Indiana Avenue will return with more words and music from Debbie Nelson after this short break. This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. This is the first episode in our 2-part series with Debbie Nelson, a legendary Naptown vocalist known for her work in blues and soul music. Before we return to our conversation, let's hear another track from Debbie Nelson and In Full Transition. From the album, Mark My Words, this is Words Can't Say. That was Debbie Nelson and the In Full Transition Band with Words Can't Say. Debbie recently spoke with WFYI's Kyle Long. Let's return to their conversation as Debbie recalls performing with Bobby Watley and Jimmy Mumford, the founders of the famous Naptown band Funk Incorporated.
And I wanted to ask about some of the musicians you worked with. Probably your main group was with Bobby Watley, as you mentioned, who was an organ player. Jimmy Mumford was a drummer.
Oh,
These were the guys that founded Funk Incorporated, which went on to become a nationally known group with hit records. Bowlegs, Cool as Back. These were on the Billboard charts. Tell me, how did you get involved working with Bobby Watley in this basically an early version of Funk Incorporated?
And what was really weird is, when I started working with Bobby Watley, he didn't even know how to play the organ. Mm. He had been a drummer. Mm. One of his friends bought him this nice, beautiful Hammett organ. And what's the three guys with the white hair?
King James Version.
Yes, the King James Version came in one night to set in. And Bobby was crazy about that organ. And so, you know, King James, he would jump all over the tables and with his Moses
staff,
stick and staff, and he would walk all over everywhere. And so one day I said, King James, get on the organ, get on the organ. I was always a prankster. I said, get up on the organ, get up on the organ. And Bobby turned and looked at him. He said, if you do, I'll kill you right here on the stage. So King James averted that and came back down. But I was having a ball. But for him not knowing the organ and what he evolved into, it was amazing. And Jimmy Munsford is my favorite drummer ever. I still remember him playing a certain part in one of my songs, hitting that drum and then standing up and looking around everybody like, yeah, I'm the baddest. I am the baddest. And sitting back down right on time and going on through with that song. But when it got to him, he'd hit those drums and stand up and just do this. Yeah, it's me. It's me. I loved him. He and Bobby Wally, I loved them. They taught me so much, and they taught me important things, not only about music, but about life. I'm just a little girl out here flagging, don't know a whole lot about anything, naive, and they taught me so much. And I remember one time I used to ask him, why you always go to the back there when we come out for break? How come nobody stands out here with me? No. Go on. But I want to go back here with you. No. Go on back up there to the front of the club where we can watch you. You don't have any business back here. Well, I learned later why. And it was because of them telling me, no, you're not coming back here with us. They saved me. They saved me because they cared for me. Always had little angels. The Lord always put little angels around me, whom I would never think would be that angel until I would reflect back on it years later and realize he was with me all the way.
Do you remember how you got started singing with Bobby and Jimmy? Was it just kind of being in at the Surfside and they liked what you did and said, you know, come on as a regular?
Up.
Yeah. When they formed Funk Incorporated, they left the city, right?
Yes.
They were touring all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ever try to get you on the road with them? Did they ever try to incorporate you in that? Or was that something
completely different?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, when Bobby then he broke off and he was playing at hotels downtown by himself. Mm-hmm. Remember, he had the drum machine. Mm-hmm. He had everything. He didn't need anybody else. And I would go up there and see him a couple of times. He would call me up to sing and everything. But we remained friends a long time up until he passed. Maybe like a few weeks before he passed, we had talked. We would talk at least 4 to 5 times a year. He would get in touch and call me and ask me how I was doing, and he would tell me about himself. So I learned a lot from him, and I learned a lot from Jimmy because he just bought it like it was.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to give you any flowers or anything. I'm just going to say it just like it is. No to this, no to that. And if I catch you, I'm going to get you. And I was scared. You know, I respected them. So I was like, okay. He was like the father I never had, never knew. And I needed that guidance, you know. And to have been blessed so much, to have been put around people who were willing to give me that guidance because they knew I needed it. So I really stayed out of lots of trouble, never been in jail, never been in prison, never shot any drugs, none of that, because of what they taught me and what they shared with me.
You talked about the power of Jimmy Munsford's drums. Do you know what sampling is in these rap songs where they sample older songs and kind of remix them?
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Munsford is probably one of the most sampled drummers in the history of rap music.
Really?
The funk incorporated music is used on some of the biggest hit records of the last 30 years.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's been sampled hundreds of times. You could name a famous rapper or R&B musician.
And they've used his drums.
Yeah, that's just part of the language of modern popular music. His drum break on a song called Cool Is Back, if you remember that record.
And you know what?
Yeah.
Some of those times I've heard things that would remind me of
him. Yeah, it's him,
it sure
probably.
Sound like Jimmy Munster.
It probably was.
Because no one could do it like he could do it. I was always so proud of him when he would just hit it and stand up.
Yeah.
And just, he would look around, shake his head, and look at each other like, I'm the baddest. And then sit back down, never miss a beat. Like, go, you go. I was so proud to be with them.
Yeah, when Funk Incorporated started taking off, and like I said, they were having hit records that were getting played on the radio, how did that make you feel? Were you excited for them?
Yes.
Did you want to be up there with them? How did you feel?
Excited for them.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know that today, but I'm really a homebody. And they think they have the perception that, oh, she loves to be out everywhere. No, I don't. When I'm not singing, I rarely go anywhere. I'm usually at home listening to gospel music. I love it. It comforts me. It calms me down.
Let's pause and listen to a classic track from Funk Incorporated. From 1971, this is Bowlegs. That was Funk Incorporated with Bowlegs. Our guest this week, Debbie Nelson, performed with the band's founders, Bobby Watley and Jimmy Mumford. Tune in next week for the second part of our conversation with Debbie Nelson. We'll end this week's show with another track from Debbie Nelson, An In Full Transition. From the album, Mark My Words, this is You're a Thing of the Past.
You know you're buried out of love. 6 feet deep. When you started running around, little boy, and cheating on me. And you gave my love to anyone who asks, but I don't worry now, little boy, you're a thing of the past.
That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for tuning in. You can meet me here on the Avenue again next week, same time, same place. And you can find the Echoes of Indiana Avenue podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcast. Echoes of Indiana Avenue is written and produced by Kyle Long and hosted and co-produced by me, Herman Butch Slaughter.
Nobody knows on uptown, baby, like I do. Nobody knows on that town, baby.